Welcome to Coin Flips and Controversies, an OrthoBullets original series dedicated to exploring gray zone decisions in orthopedic surgery.
This episode of Coin Flips and Controversies is sponsored by MASSES, the Middle Atlantic Shoulder and Elbow Society annual meeting, taking place this September in Washington, D.C. At this time, we will hand it over to the webinar faculty. We hope you enjoy the webinar.
All right, so I'll get started here. So welcome everybody to the MASSES 2023 webinar on primary shoulder instability. We're really excited to have this webinar for you tonight. We picked a pretty interesting case. We got some expert panelists here who we're going to introduce in just a second. Just to get started, my name is Eric Black. I'm in private practice in Northern New Jersey. I'm the vice chair of orthopedics and the chief of shoulder and elbow surgery. I've been in practice for about 10 years and happy to be a part of this. Next, let's go to Ashley.
Thanks, Eric. I'm really excited to be here today and looking forward to your case. So my name is Ashley Bassett. I'm also in private practice in Northern New Jersey. I've been in practice for about 5 years. As Yanni and I were talking about before, I am a co-host of a podcast, the Sports Docs podcast, and I also work with USA Gymnastics. So excited to be here and talk more about this topic.
Okay, let's go to Larry.
Great. Thanks, Eric. And again, thanks for the invitation to participate on this. My name is Larry Galata. I'm the chief of the shoulder and elbow division in the Sports Medicine Institute and Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City. And I'm also the head team orthopedic surgeon for the New York Mets. I've been in practice for about 14 years. And to this day, I still think the Mid-Atlantic Shoulder and Elbow meeting in DC is one of my favorite meetings every year. It's largely unscripted. It's a symposium case-based discussion. You're not bombarded with lectures, and the course organizers always do a great job to keep things lively and entertaining. So if you have the opportunity, we'd love to see you there.
Couldn't agree more. Finally, to round it out, let's talk about Yoni.
What's going on, guys? Doctors, thanks for having me. I'm the only non-surgeon on the panel. I'm a sports physical therapist in private practice. I founded True Sports Physical Therapy, and we've grown to a team of 40 sports physical therapists in Maryland, Pennsylvania, now in Delaware, and we provide the highest levels of care to the highest levels of athlete. I love this case because I'm director of sports medicine for the Israeli national lacrosse team, so I travel to the World Games with them, and being a Baltimore boy myself, we see a ton of lacrosse players, so I'm excited to contribute and learn.
Perfect. And that was not planned. So this is going to be great. We got a great lineup, and we're really excited to hopefully share some knowledge and maybe some controversy tonight. Okay, so we're going to get started here. So to Yoni's liking, this is going to be an interesting case about a 17-year-old Division I hopeful lacrosse player. So he's a 17-year-old male, came to my clinic. He's right-handed of note. He presented to me a couple days after his second left shoulder dislocation. So he dislocated his shoulder about 6 months prior to seeing me in the middle of his lacrosse season in the spring. And he saw me right around September. He was boogie boarding down the shore and dislocated it. He wiped out and his arm was hanging on his side. He went to the ER, dislocated it. He had popped it back in by the emergency room. And he came to me in a sling. Of note, he's a very competitive attacker. So that's, I think, relevant for this case. So attacker basically is a pretty significant agility player. You need both arms. You shoot from both sides. You need a lot of range of motion. He's a senior in high school. So we're just starting in September, which I think will be relevant for us to talk about. And he's been accepted. He has a scholarship at a Division I school to play lacrosse. So all of those pretty relevant to what we're going to discuss. Otherwise, he's healthy, no previous surgeries. On examination, he has an acutely painful shoulder. He does have apprehension at terminal abduction and external rotation, but he does not have apprehension in mid-abduction. Otherwise, his cuff strength is intact. He's firing his deltoid. Pretty unremarkable exam otherwise. So maybe I'll take it to Ashley. Maybe we'll kick through some films. Tell me what you see, what's relevant, and tell me what you see maybe on this first starting film.
Yeah, so this looks like an AP radiograph demonstrating an anterior glenohumeral dislocation. I think you also have a scapular Y radiograph just below it.
I do.
Demonstrating the same. You can see anterior translation of the humeral head. And then I anticipate the next two are post-reduction. So this is a post-reduction AP left shoulder showing successful concentric glenohumeral reduction. I don't see any obvious Hill Sachs impaction on this view, though, of course, we'll look to the MRI for a bit more information on that. And then I also don't see any loss of that normal sclerotic anterior glenoid, which is somewhat reassuring for lack of significant glenoid bone loss.
So I think for those of the folks who are watching this webinar who might be a little bit more junior in their status, do you insist on an axillary view or some sort of an orthogonal view? And is this scapular Y view acceptable? Can they leave the ER? Are they totally reduced? Or is this something where you'd say, you know, you got to do something more if you're the resident on call, let's say, and they say, you know what, the shoulder's in, we're pretty confident, let's let him go.
So I think we both trained in the same place. I think if I showed up to morning trauma rounds after a glenohumeral reduction without an axillary, I think we would have gotten in trouble. So I am insisting on an axillary view just to make sure, especially, I mean, this is an anterior dislocation, but posterior dislocations, you certainly can miss. And so I always get an axillary view with any concern for instability, especially post-reduction.
Yeah, I agree. Larry, what do you think? Do you agree with Ashley? Do you see any signs of a Hill Sachs? Is there anything that concerns you about this x-ray?
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the classic x-ray that is brought in either from the emergency room or maybe your urgent care or so, where you're really getting an obliquogram of the shoulder itself. We're getting an AP of the chest and we're getting an oblique of the shoulder. We're not getting a true grassy or AP view of the shoulder. That's how I think you can really tell whether or not you have that glenoid bone loss, because, you know, Ashley talked about it, where you lose that cortical rim of the that inferior portion of the glenoid in the setting of some anterior bone loss. So here, I don't know that you can fully appreciate that. I can maybe convince myself that there's a little shadow of where there's going to be a Hill Sachs, but relatively small, and only because, you know, almost by definition, if he's got a formal kind of locked out dislocation, he's going to have some form of a Hill Sachs. So you sort of have to know what to look for here.
Yeah, I agree. I think just like Ashley mentioned, I tend to be pretty insistent that at least if they're having repeat radiographs in the office, I'll get a good axillary, or at the very least a Velpo, some sort of an orthogonal view to see the true the view of the anterior glenoid. We can really gain a lot of information on whether there's an anterior glenoid rim fracture. I think probably in all of our practices, I think that's the thing that ERs and other physicians probably tend to miss the most, is a subtle anterior glenoid rim fracture. So that's something I always look out for, that you could see on plain radiographs, especially if you have a really good radiographer. So this is New York, New Jersey, especially with the HSS folks. We're getting an MRI right away, right, Larry? So Larry, why don't you take us through this MRI?
Well, sure. Let's see. So first of all, this is an acute injury. So here I do not feel that you need dye or contrast in. You're going to have some hematoma in there, so you're going to see everything quite fine, just as it is. Here you're looking at the axial, and really at this cut here, you know, you can maybe start to convince yourself there's a very subtle line of the anterior labrum, but where we are right here, I'm not seeing anything too terrible.
I'll move down a bit.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. So as you keep going down, you're starting to see some blunting of the anterior labrum. And what do you have for the next one? And there we're seeing, tear of the anterior labrum with even some stripping of the periosteum anteriorly as well. So this is a pretty classic ELPSA type lesion.
Yeah, so I agree, you're showing me
right there. I'm not fully appreciating any significant glenoid bone loss, but we, you know, like to look at the sagittal to really be able to tell, because you start to see things out of plane here. So here on the sagittal, we're starting to see, at least on this view, what I consider a minimal Hill Sachs lesion. You see the contusion of the posterolateral humeral head here. And then these are the fluid sensitive sequences. Now we got a proton density sequence, just, you know, again, confirming that we have what I consider a minimal Hill Sachs lesion. But then this is the view that I really like here. So we're looking at this parasagittal image of really the on-foss view of the glenoid here. And you're definitely seeing blunting of the anterior glenoid here. You see posteriorly, you see that nice rounded kind of pear-shaped appearance to it, and we're definitely getting a little blunting. So this patient, it does have some minimal glenoid bone loss here. And
yeah, I would agree. I measured about 8%. So we're calling this 8%. So I mean, how sensitive do you think MRIs, certainly with 3T MRI, high quality MRIs can be pretty good if you have the right cuts, but do you think a CT is necessary? Maybe in this case, or always, do you tend to get CTs on these patients where you're worried about glenoid bone loss? Maybe Ashley, you can answer that.
Yeah, so for me, I think I can glean enough from the MRIs, especially I insist on a 3T MRI for all of my patients. I think it yields the best detail. I think if someone is borderline, so we'll talk, I'm sure, in a little bit about treatment based on percent bone loss and Hill-Sachs lesion severity. But if someone's borderline, like I'm calculating a 17 or 18, and I'm really wondering if they're really above 20 or less than that, I'll get a humeral head subtraction, a 3D CT to really calculate it. But most of the time, I feel like I can gain all the information that I need from the MRI itself.
Larry, how about you guys at HSS? Do you typically get CT scans routinely, or are you relying on the MRI?
No, I think, you know, I'd say 90 to 95% of the time I get the data or the information I need to decision make based on the MRI.
Yeah, I agree with you on this case. Sometimes I think when patients come in with low quality MRIs and you can see enough that there's some periosteal stripping, you know, there's some soft tissue problems and you kind of get a general sense of the labrum, ligament and other soft tissue structures. If I'm really concerned about bone loss, I will get a CT scan. But I think most of the time, if you can get the cut right on this sagittal view, you could pretty much see that there's not a dramatic amount of bone loss. And we'll talk about critical, subcritical bone loss later. But I think we're all in agreement that we're probably not going to rush to get a CT scan. And then I rounded out a couple of other images here. You could see that the rotator cuff's intact. There's probably a little bit of a teardrop sign, maybe some capsule or stretch. And so these are just some coronal views, just kind of showing the capsule in different views. Maybe the superior labrum looks to be reasonable, but there's definitely some capsular stretch here. So Yoni, I'll turn it to you. When you have a lacrosse player with shoulder instability, a history of dislocations, do you see a lot of these lacrosse players as being hyperlax individuals? Are these tight individuals? Do you like them to be a little bit loose, maybe in their pre-morbid state? What's kind of the ideal anatomy and movement that these patients and players do well with?
Yeah, I mean, especially the attack, they're usually shorter, stouter, quicker. Those guys are usually tight by nature. The difference in layback or max external rotation at 90 degrees of abduction, it's so different lacrosse versus like the baseball and the pitcher athlete. Those pitchers very often are loosey-goosey. That's a technical term. And really able to like reach to these far end ranges. That's not usually lacrosse. Because remember, it's like this awesome hodgepodge of running back and pitcher, and they have to be able to like juke themselves open. And so usually they're taut and explosive versus kind of like the flimsy pitcher.
So what, I mean, I guess if we had a patient that was a lacrosse player, it's different than a patient who, Ashley, you work with a lot of gymnasts. You see a patient who comes in with an acute dislocation. Do you think about things a little bit differently in your younger, super agile, really flexible gymnasts? Are you going to manage this patient necessarily differently than if you have a contact athlete? It's a little bit of a loaded question. We can get into it more, but.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I feel like most of my gymnasts, they tend to be hyperflexible. They tend to be younger female athletes. We know from the studies that this population is the group that tends to have less intra-articular injuries. They tend to have more of that capsular laxity. They don't tend to have associated labrum tears. And if they have a Hill-Sachs, it's quite minor. And so these are patients where I'm really trying some non-operative treatment off the bat rather than, we'll get into this in a little bit, but a contact athlete with a Bankart lesion and a Hill-Sachs, that you worry about that recurrence. Of course, they're, you know, being hyperlax, that is a recurrence risk, but I worry about that a little bit less than an male contact athlete, competitive lacrosse player that we're talking about.
Larry, how about in your baseball players? Tell us about a little bit more about baseball.
Well, I mean, the people who are having traumatic injuries are usually position players. The people diving in headfirst to second base or diving for a ball in the field or so. Those can be, you know, those are sort of run-of-the-mill athletes in so much that they're not hyper-lax, but they're not super hyper-tight either. And you treat those like, you know, you would a football player or lacrosse player. You know, the pitchers and capsular tears and instability, that's a whole different conversation.
Whole different ballgame.
I think it's, yeah, outside the scope probably where we're going with this.
I agree. Yeah, I take care of a lot of hockey players, and I would agree these hockey players are, it's a little different than lacrosse because their arms are down low and they take contact below shoulder level with their arms in adduction. So they tend to have a lot more AC joint injuries, but when they get shoulder dislocations, they get around the world tears because their shoulders go in all different directions. So it's interesting just to kind of get a breath of the different sports that we all take care of and how we manage them. It's certainly different. And the idea of something, when you look at the literature of a contact athlete, I think varies because lacrosse contact is different than a position player in baseball, is different than soccer, quote unquote, contact and football. So I think it's something that we all think about, but maybe we don't discuss a lot in the literature when we talk about the word contact athlete. It's not quite a definition that's a one size fits all. So is there anything else that you guys want to know about this patient, or are we going straight to surgery? Or tell me a little bit more about kind of your thoughts, Ashley. How are we going to manage this patient right now? It's September. The kid's got lacrosse season in the spring. He's going to be a D1 hopeful. He's got a lot riding on this.
Yeah. So for me, I mean, I'm advising surgery for this patient. I'll just cut right to it. I think, you know, even if he was having a first time instability episode, given his age, given his contact sport, given that he's an attacker, given that he's male, and given that he has some subcritical, but still bipolar bone loss, I have concerns with managing him non-operatively. Of course, if he's mid-season, you can have that discussion. But I think given all those risks, especially he's committed to play D1, you know, at a high level, I think surgery is the right answer for him.
Yoni, talk to me about timing. So it's September. You take care of a lot of lacrosse players. These kids are usually all year long lacrosse. So there really does not exist one single season in lacrosse, but it's September. How are you going to advise this patient? You're obviously going to be on the side of whatever surgeon is treating him. So if we decide to go ahead with surgery, you're going to be intimately involved in his rehab. Tell me a little bit about how you're going to advise this patient and the doctor about when's the ideal time to operate on this kid.
So I hate to disagree with you because I'm not always on the side of the surgeon.
But okay, maybe you're not. So that's a good thing. I like that. There's controversy here. This is a controversial topic.
But I think it's looking at it holistically. And like Dr. Bassett said, kind of figuring out where you are in season. You're gearing up for January. First of all, he's a senior in high school, right?
Senior in high school.
Yeah. So I have a very frank conversation with him. Like, when you get on the lacrosse field, most likely this is going to happen again. You have 4 years that someone's paying you some amount of money to go to college to play your sport at the Division I level. We don't want it to happen then, because then you're at risk for losing maybe some type of scholarship. So you better believe I'm pushing him towards surgery. So in this case, I would agree with the surgeon to get him rolling for surgery. And this is one of the cases where I don't need to spend that much time with him pre-surgery. I like to do that a lot if time allows. But in this case, let's get a fix so we can kind of get cranking, because God knows what kind of sports medicine care he's going to get when he goes to that Division I program. I want to spend as much time with him here before that happens.
Now that we're on the subject, I'd love to spend like, you know, a minute of your time to talk about prehab. Let's assume that it's, you know, he's in season. We're going to let him finish out his season. Tell us, you know, the three main things that you're going to tell this kid. You have to focus on these three things. These are the most important things to keep your shoulders stable. What do us as orthopedic surgeons, how can we relay that information? Because a lot of times they ask and we say, strengthen your rotator cuff, work on your periscapular muscles, but, you know, get a little bit granular. Tell us exactly what you want this kid to do to maximize the chance that he's going to be as stable as possible throughout the season.
Number one is cuff recruitment, and that's your brain's ability to actually talk to the cuff and for you to be able to activate, turn on the cuff, and then fatigue the cuff. They have to become best friends with their cuff. Very few athletes know how to do that. We're going to spend a huge amount of time. That's a number one. That's going to help them as soon as they wake up from surgery. They're going to be able to start doing some scap retractions. They should know what it feels like. Number two is end range stability. So to whatever level comfortable we can get him, I want to put him at those end ranges, make him own those positions. That would be number two. And number three is, what is your core doing? What does the word core mean? How do we introduce that to you leading up to surgery? Because you're going to be able to get after your core way faster than you're going to be able to get after your shoulder post-op. Let's make that a priority.
Mm-hmm. And Larry, do you think there's any role for bracing these patients in season? What kind of brace do you like to use? Maybe, you know, leave some of the brands out of it, but is there one particular brace characteristic that you like more than others? Do you think there's a role for bracing? Maybe it depends on the sport.
Yeah, I think it depends on the sport. I don't think a lacrosse player, particularly an attack, can be braced. They're not going to be able to shoot to a level that they're going to be satisfied with. You know, potentially a defender, long pole might be able to do it. But really, for me, this is the football player, the lineman, the linebackers, you know, the people that probably, you know, don't go from any interceptions over their head. Then we'll do something that straps their shoulder pad and literally works by holding the arm down by their side, really preventing them from getting into a position of instability that is up overhead in the Aber position here.
Yeah, so. I agree. I think it depends on the position, because you tell an attacker to wear a brace and they can't get their stick up in the air and they can't do the things that they need to do. Whereas football linemen and other low positions, it's much easier. So I agree. Let's go to the first poll here and kind of see what. Yeah.
Sorry, Doc. One more thing I would think about is, obviously this is male and the case is a male, but the sports are very different. So if this is a female lacrosse player, yes, less contact, but far less external rotation needs, because they can't get back there because the stick doesn't hold the ball as well. So they're not going to be able to get to that layback. Those athletes I've seen have some success with bracing because they don't need the layback.
That's a great comment. Thank you. It's awesome.
Eric, just another just comment, and you alluded to it, where lacrosse is a year-round sport. And I've been seeing it. I was making a comment to one of our fellows just the other day that lacrosse, it seems like every season is the most important season.
Always. Yep.
From your eighth grade year till your senior year in high school. It's our biggest recruiting season. It goes nonstop. Lacrosse is the number one group of athletes that I tell them that the best thing for their kid and their kid's shoulder is to have a surgery, and they don't listen. Like, I mean, I think I'm probably batting 15 to 20% in terms of actually, you know, getting people to sign up for surgery that I truly think are indicated for it. Or so,
you know,
football players do it, the baseball players do it, the basketball players do it, the lacrosse players never do it.
There's never a good time. They are four seasons a year, always playing. They get supposed commitment letters when they're in eighth grade. Thankfully, I think some of the rules have changed, but I used to have kids coming in. They say, Princeton wrote me a letter. They're committing to me. I'm in eighth grade. And I'd say, that's insane. Things can change. So these kids are very passionate about their sport. There's no question about it. So let's get down to the nitty gritty. So question number one, this is the third poll question, but I think we sort of chose a few just for topics of conversation. If you choose operative management, what treatment are you going to perform? So let's go down the line. Yoni, if you want to abstain, if you want to talk about it, certainly based on your knowledge of treating thousands of these patients, I'd love to have you do some input. I'll tell you what I did, but maybe let's start with you, Ashley.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to hear what everyone says about this, because I think this is where we get into the controversy, right? I think that depending on what kind of athlete you're taking care of, a hockey player like you do, a baseball player, a football player, a lacrosse player, they're going to want different things, right? You know, everyone in the NHL, they've seen Laterge, they trust Laterge for their shoulder instability. And in the NFL, they mostly trust Benkart. And so I think a lot of it has to do with the athlete, the surgeon who's doing it, and then also some of the other criteria. So for me, I'm doing an arthroscopic Benkart repair with a remplissage in this patient. So he has the subcritical bone loss of 8%, as you highlighted. He has a pretty shallow, small, what looks to be on track Hill-Sachs lesion, but he is still somewhat high risk. I like the idea of not jumping to a Laterge. It saves that as a secondary procedure. And you know, the complication rate of Laterge can reach 20 to 30%. So I obviously don't want to commit someone to that if we can avoid that, but I don't think he can just be a Benkart repair alone. I think he's too high risk. Any bone loss, and he does have a Hill-Sachs, he's a contact athlete, he's high level D1. And I do worry about the loss of motion with a Laterge, him not being able to get into that abduction external rotation position that he's going to need to shoot on both sides, even though it's his non-dominant. So, but I think we need to back it up more. And I think there's increasing data that suggests doing a remplissage for on-track Hill-Sachs lesions in high-risk people lowers that rate of recurrence, particularly in patients that have some bone loss, but it's less than 15%. Pat Denard and Albert Lin published a recent paper on this. So this patient for me is getting an arthroscopic Benkart repair and an arthroscopic remplissage. That's my decision.
Yeah, I think you said so many incredibly brilliant things there. And I think, you know, a couple of things that I want to focus on later, this idea of subcritical bone loss versus critical bone loss, the idea of on-track, off-track lesions, and should we be doing remplissage? So we'll put in patients who maybe don't have obviously engaging Hill-Sachs. And those are three things I definitely want to talk about, but let's hear what Larry has to say first.
Yeah, it's hard to add to what Ashley said. I think you really covered that topic very nicely. You know, this is one of these ones though that I call it's the Goldilocks here, where just a Benkart alone isn't probably enough for a contact athlete, and then the Laterge is probably, I think, too much for somebody with this amount of subcritical bone loss. And just as Ashley talked about, the Pat Denard paper with Alex Laterman on it did a really nice job of showing that they can have equivalent results with a soft tissue arthroscopic procedure with a remplissage compared to a Laterge with this in this amount of bone loss here. So I'm with a arthroscopic Benkart repair with a remplissage here in this case too.
Yoni, any thoughts on kind of what we talked about in terms of experience you've seen? You know, talk about tightness after Laterge. Do you worry about that when you see these patients?
Yeah, I mean, I'm terrified by that because that makes my life miserable. So when they come out that stiff, it's over. I have seen ladder Js get far better in terms of getting that motion back over the years. I think that that used to just be far worse. But I'm happy to hear everyone's choice here because I'm no surgeon, but that's what I'm hoping walks in, that it's done arthroscopically and that it's done with the Remplissage. I think that sets you up for the best success.
Yeah. So I'll post the results and then we can kind of talk about it and kind of see what the poll said and then maybe deconstruct. Cause I think for those of you, so obviously the arthroscopic Bankart repair plus Remplissage wins out 77%. We have one person, a couple of people that did not choose operative management. We talked about free bone block. So I want to chat about that a bit. 14% said ladder J and 4% said, I don't really know what to do. So I think I'd like to maybe talk a little bit about this idea of critical versus subcritical bone loss. So I think, you know, for those of us who have read the papers, you know, we talk about 12%, 13% subcritical. We talk about 20% as critical. You know, these numbers are floated around and how much do they matter? How much in this particular case, do you think about 8%? I think we could all pretty much agree that it's subcritical bone loss, but maybe we'll get to the next question when it comes to numbers. But how much does bone loss really play into this? I mean, I think we know the answer, and I'm going to throw you a little bit of a softball, Ashley, but how much does bone loss really factor into this decision, Bankart versus ladder J?
Yeah, so I think exactly what you alluded to. I think it factors in, but I don't think it's the only deciding factor. I think if you have one of those gray zone, you know, 13.5, 14%, but they have an off-track Hill-Sachs lesion, right? That's going to push you more towards a bone restoration procedure. Or if they're more gray zone, but they are a contact athlete, maybe like a football player that doesn't need that severe abduction external rotation, then maybe we're talking about a bone restoration procedure. So for me, yes, that traditional, anything over 20% is obviously getting a bony procedure. Anything under 10% is typically not getting a bony procedure. That middle ground, you know, I'm looking at that 12 to 13%. In someone like him, though, I'm kind of hanging my hat on that Pat Dennard paper we keep referencing. Anything below 15% arthroscopic Bankart plus a Remplissage did well. I'd really hate to commit into a ladder J. So I'd probably only do that in something maybe over 15%. In him.
There's been a lot of debate about Remplissage. You know, maybe 10 years ago when I was coming out of training, people said you lose range of motion. People don't do well after Remplissage. I'm going to say something controversial and I'm curious to hear what you guys think about it. I rarely don't do Remplissage if I see even a small Hill-Sachs lesion in a patient like this. I think in a patient who is a high level athlete, who I'm worried that they're going to put their shoulder under a tremendous amount of stress, you know, I kind of use some of these papers, especially the idea that a Remplissage, at least in my practice, I don't see them losing a ton of range of motion. And I feel like it's that extra belt and suspenders, if there's even a hint of bone loss and a small non-engaging Hill-Sachs lesion, and the idea of subcritical bone loss, even with an on-track lesion, I have a pretty low threshold to do a Remplissage. Do you guys agree with that? Do you think that's ridiculous? How about Larry? Why don't you tell me if I'm silly?
Yeah, no, I think for me, it's more the contact athlete versus the non-contact athlete. And if it's a contact athlete, then I would agree 110% with you. I think that the vast majority of those that are getting arthroscopic procedures, if not all of them, are getting a Remplissage. You kind of run your mill pickup basketball kid who's playing intramurals in college and whatnot, then no, I don't necessarily go to the Remplissage unless I do think it's one of those tweener cases where you do start to get up to that, you know, maybe 15, 20% bone loss on the glenoid or large Hill-Sachs and off, you know, getting to it going near track lesion or so, then maybe I'll do it just to hedge my bets or so. But with contact athlete, yeah, I agree with you. It's getting it pretty much every time.
Yoni, do you see these patients with Remplissage when you get the operative report, you know they've had a Remplissage? Do you think in your experience it makes a big difference in terms of their range of motion when you're rehabbing them? Do you do anything different?
I don't do anything different. And I don't see drastic differences, ranges of motion. I think it's I think in this instance, non-dominant and lacrosse, that makes all the sense in the world. I don't care that much about those last 5 degrees. This guy's a pitcher. Number one, Dr. Galata told me he's never repairing a pitcher's shoulder. And number two, that's when it would matter, right? Like those few degrees really matter. It's also interesting. I don't know if it's a geographic thing. We don't see tons and tons of Remplissage where I'm practicing. Like, I feel like I wish I saw it more. I don't know if you guys, I mean, everyone here is kind of tri-state. I don't know if you know any colleagues that are not doing it as much as you guys.
Yeah, I think it's something that's definitely trending up. You know, I think the more conferences and courses you go to, your people talking from the podium that have a lot of experience with it. You know, I think the consensus is that it has been a pretty effective way to stabilize the shoulder above and beyond the standard arthroscopic Bankart repair. It doesn't have much of a downside, as Eric said, in terms of limiting the external rotation. So I think people are seeing it as not much of a downside. Now, I will tell you, you know, I heard a couple people rumble about some cuff pain afterwards, and I sort of poo-pooed that in the beginning. But now that I've increased my utility of this, I definitely now have a couple patients out there that sort of have this persistent cuff pain. Fortunately, most, though not one, has gotten better with an injection. But it is something that I think we're probably going to start seeing more and more.
Now, from a technical perspective, go for it, Yoni.
I was going to say, is that the reason that cuff pain, like what? To not do it in the intramural basketball player? What's keeping you from doing it?
It's a good point. So in terms of, you're right. I think though, the arthroscopic Bankart has been an overall pretty decent procedure in the recreational athlete. You know, that's not necessarily the athlete that I'm overly worried about. So it is more anchors. It is more operative time. It is, that potential complication of having some cuff pain requiring an injection afterwards. Those are all the reasons for why the non-contact, non-competitive athlete would just get a standard Bankart. You don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, let's be honest, it's been a good surgery for the vast majority of patients for a number of years.
Yeah, according to Bill Levine, I hope he watches this. This patient will fail miserably if he gets an arthroscopic Bankart with Remplissage. So I did an arthroscopic Bankart with Remplissage, but many people, including some of our mentors, Anand Murthy and Bill Levine, disagree. So I'll ask Ashley, how many open Bankarts have you done in practice? I'm just curious, because I've done like four. And maybe that's a product of my training, but zero. Larry, how about you? Yeah. You're an academic institution. How often do you do an open Bankart repair?
Yeah, that's it. It's pretty rare. It's really in the setting of somebody with just global multi-directional instability where I really want to get that laterally based capsular shift in there as well. I think I can do a better job with that open. But for these traumatic unidirectionals, they're getting a scope typically.
Yeah, I agree.
I will also add that, you know, I think it's also a product of how we're being trained, right? I'm 4 years out of fellowship. We didn't see a lot of open Bankarts. I think it really is a lost art. I think there's definitely a utility for it. I definitely think that hyperlax patchless anterior capsule, you know, that you really want to tighten up, do a capsular plication. I think it's a really, really beneficial surgery. I also think in maybe even some cases of revision where you don't have significant bone loss, but you really just don't trust a revision arthroscopic Bankart. So don't interpret my zero as that I'm anti. It's just, I don't think we see it a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're looking for, I think when you look at Pagnani papers and Advisors papers, like there's really good long-term data to support open Bankarts for sure. And I think the recurrence rates 3-4% that they publish are pretty outstanding. But I think nowadays, when you look at some of these long-term studies with the updated Bankart, like Larry mentioned, lots of anchors, capsular placation stitches, you know, more clustered anchors that are smaller as opposed to like two of these larger anchors or metal anchors that we used, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, adding in a Remplissage, I think we're starting to see this trickle up 3%, 2% recurrence rates, and the complication rates are dramatically lower. I think I could tell you, I can count on many hands the number of patients I've seen 10, 15 years after an open Bankart surgery. They have arthritis and we're going in to do an anatomic total shoulder or some, maybe a reverse, depending on the level of their subscap. Their subscaps are never the same. And I know that that's something I looked up for this conference, what's the rate of subscap failure? And it's something that's not published about a ton. And some published up to 25%, people get belly press signs and weakness to internal rotation. But that scares me to death, the idea of taking a patient like this, a 17-year-old elite athlete who you do an open Bankart on and you take down their subscap and maybe their subscap doesn't heal perfectly well. And you've just paralyzed their arm effectively, which is to me much worse than a 3-5% chance of recurrence. I don't know if you guys disagree, agree. Tell me your thoughts.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think also you have to plan for the future too, right? We want to think that we've perfectly given back this native shoulder and they're never going to develop any post-traumatic arthritis, but we know that that's not true, right? So if we're thinking forward towards maybe needing an anatomic total shoulder in the future, you know, they've shown, you know, arthroscopic versus open, you know, higher risk of subscap failure. And so you really want to try to preserve that subscap. So I think doing as much arthroscopic work as you can, whether it's an arthroscopic Bankart or whether we'll get into this, arthroscopic bone block or arthroscopic ladder J, anything to preserve that subscap, I think is really important.
Yeah, I agree. So let's get on to the next question. So let's talk a little bit more about bone loss. So what is your threshold to consider a bone procedure in this patient specifically? So, you know, maybe in general, but let's talk about this patient specifically. Is it 10%, 10 to 15? Ashley, what do you think?
I'm going to go with option 4, greater than 15%, based on the, you know, less than 15 plus, you know, Bankar plus remplissage should hopefully decrease his risk of recurrence. And I'd really like to avoid the complications of Lattergé, including loss of that abduction and external rotation.
Larry, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I would totally agree. You know, I do think obviously that the whole idea of the glenoid track, I do think is important. So it's not just the glenoid bone loss in isolation, but it's in combination with how broad or wide the Hill-Sachs lesion as well. So we do have the residents and fellows, I think, about that and calculate that. So we're trying to make an educated decision on it.
Do you typically look at the glenoid track on every patient that you operate on? Is that sort of a thing you hang your hat on, or is that just one other piece of information that helps you make the decision?
Yeah, it's one other piece of the information here. I think, let's be honest with it. I mean, in the tri-state area, this is a very classic case that we're seeing. A kid who dislocated twice. He's got, you know, his first or second MRI, they're rushing into one of our offices. Okay. So, you know, my experience has been that very rarely does that patient need a bone grafting procedure with the amount of bone loss that they're going to present to you with. Okay. Now that might be, there's going to be, I'm sure, some geographic and some socioeconomic differences with that. So if you're in an area where, you know, you're not seeing the type A, you know, New Yorkers or metropolitan, you know, people or so, like, you might see somebody who comes in with 20, you know, instability episodes, and they might come in more consistently with 20% bone loss or 25% bone loss. So, you know, but that's just not the patient population that I'm typically seeing. So for me, I mean, this is largely a binary thing. It's either you have pretty minimal bone loss for a primary procedure and we're doing a scope, probably also a remplissage in the contact athlete, or you've really kind of neglected your shoulder for years and years, or you failed a previous attempt at a scope. And then we're thinking more of a bone grafting open procedure here by way of a Lattergé. And every now and then we get into one of these tweeners and we can perseverate a little bit about it. And that's when the glenoid track comes into factor for me.
Yeah, I think that's well said. I think the idea of neglect is very interesting because an elite athlete like this is going to be all over it, seeing 7 opinions, probably seeing 3 of us plus 5 other people. And these people, it's more like these, you know, like you said, a pickup basketball player, a collegiate kid who's just sort of a recreational guy. Maybe he's playing a little bit of, you know, this, a little bit of that, and he'll let his shoulder dislocate 30 times. And then he comes to you finally when he's dislocating in his sleep. And I agree, then it's usually pretty obvious what you're going to do, but on athletes like this, they're usually on top of it. So let's see what the poll says. All right. So we got 19%, 10 to 15. So those people are going to do a Lattergé for a little bit less bone loss. And I think, you know, there's an argument between 16 to 20% and 21 to 25. So I think, you know, generally agreement here, 21 to 25 seems a little aggressive to me. I agree. 16 to 20% probably is the sweet spot, but it kind of depends on the personality of the kid. And again, you know, for a position like this, I'd worry a little bit about a Lattergé, but I agree with you. I think it's probably something that is worthwhile in this type of patient if he's got 15 to 20% bone loss. So let's talk a little bit about a free bone block. So this is getting a lot of attention at the conferences recently. Is that something you guys are routinely doing, or is it sort of a niche thing that you'll do for only very rare circumstances? Larry, how about you?
Yeah, it's a niche thing for me. I mean, I still think my bone grafting procedure of choice is an open Lattergé if I feel the patient's indicated for it. When the Lattergé fails, that's my indication for using distal tibial allograft. And I did have actually a high school football player who came in and he was missing about a third of his glenoid. Again, 17-year-old kid, that was the neglect category, is unusual. But I did want to get some cartilage back up at the joint. I thought I was really having to reconstruct a significant part of it. So we did a distal tibial allograft.
Are you doing that open or arthroscopically?
I played around with it arthroscopically, trying to go through the rotator interval like Ivan Wong's described.
Yeah.
I think that it is, it's futsy. I think that port of Halifax is a safe portal, but it's pretty unsettling to make if anybody here has made that before, because it really comes out in the chest, you know, adjacent almost to where the patient's nipple would be, is where that ultimately goes in. I think you could take a very complicated, you know, arthroscopic procedure, and you can make it into a very easy open procedure. And in my hands, that's where I'm leaning to these days.
How do you feel? Do you take down the subscap? Do you split the subscap when you're doing this procedure?
So it's, split the subscap. So
yeah, I would agree. Ashley, have you done that procedure? Do you have any experience with any bone block procedures?
So I completely agree with Larry. My bone restoration procedure of choice is a ladder J. I have not done a free bone block procedure. I would reserve that for larger defects that maybe the coracoid just isn't large enough, or in cases of significant articular cartilage loss, like Larry was saying, being able to restore that. I think the options though are really expanding. I mean, distal clavicle autograft is a really awesome option. It's an autograft. So in terms of healing rate, it's great. It's got the local cartilage, which is really great too. And then there's the distal radius allograft, which was just presented at our AOSSM meeting a couple weeks ago, out of Rothman. Joe Abood had presented that, and that's showing, you know, some pretty interesting, you know, matching up of the curvature rate, you know, radius of curvature and the convexity. And so really interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah, I agree. Sometimes I think it's funny because I think the three of us agree. I tend to lean towards a ladder J as my bone graft restoration of choice, and then distal tibia as my secondary revision or with very, very large amounts of bone loss. But I think in my experience, these allografts are very expensive and they're hard to get. I think logistically, that's something that people don't talk about, is that you have to have a patient almost on call. You have to get this allograft cleared. It has to be fresh. They have to pass all the tests, and then you have a 2-week window to implant it. And then it's an incredible amount of money. And so there's a lot of coordination that goes into it. So it's not just something where I think willy-nilly, I'm going to sign someone up if they have a little bit of bone loss, but it's probably more of a salvage operation, revision, severe bone loss, those types of things. So let's see what the poll says.
Hey, Eric, I was just going to make a comment. I think definitely is an amount of bone loss whereby you've exceeded the ability of a ladder J to stabilize the shoulder. Okay. And these are those neglect situations or so where they have significant glenoid bone loss. So Sam Taylor at our institution has done a good amount of work on it. And he's found really two things. One is that if you're going to do a bone graft procedure, you really want to aim to restore the bone, the glenoid, back to 100% of the native diameter of it. So you really got to get all the way there. The second thing that he talks about is that it's very straightforward, but on your CAT scan, because if you have this amount of bone loss, this is an indication for me to get a CAT scan, but you can simply just measure the width of the coracoid and then see if that width of the coracoid brings you back to what you think is going to be 100% of the native glenoid. And if it does, then great, you can do a ladder J. And if it doesn't, then I think that's when you need to start thinking about a distal tibial allograft instead of a ladder J.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the CT scan is incredibly helpful, and you really, it's incredible when you do a lot of ladder J's, how much variation you see in the patients, how big or small their coracoid is. And that's not always necessarily lining up with the size of the patient. So it's one of those things that definitely that I've learned from Sam, and I've been measuring all the coracoids that I take, especially preoperatively, because usually these patients end up getting CT scans. So interestingly, you know, people are doing scapular spine autografts, and this is more of an allo autograft question, not necessarily ladder J, but there's definitely a big push in this poll for iliac crest bone graft. So the old school way to do it, Eden Hibonet, and then some people are talking about distal tibia, and then Joe Abood might have ridden 4 out of 146 distal radius, and maybe some of his fellows. But it seems to be a smattering, generally it still seems like autograft iliac crest, which I think none of us mentioned. I've maybe done a very small handful of them, but when it comes to distal tibia fits well. And I think having that fresh cartilage is really nice, and it makes me feel better on a 17-year-old than just putting a big hunk of bone that has no cartilage, and the tricortical graft just never seems to sit quite right. All right. Any other comments while we're switching gears on questions?
Yeah, I would be worried again in a contact athlete about taking a tricortical graft from the iliac crest there too. You know, I mean, these are kids that are going to fall on their side and whatnot. And I think, you know, granted, this isn't the same patient population, but I know Tom Norris, when he was talking about, you know, taking iliac crest in the setting of arthroplasty, I mean, there's a not insignificant group of patients there that can get iliac wing fractures or certainly seromas or persistent pain in that area.
Yeah, so I think the complication with nerve palsies, even temporary, is upwards of 50% in certain series. It's pretty dramatic. And you take a young kid, and we talk about this in OATS and taking cartilage from the knee, putting it in the elbow. It's, you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. And in an athlete like that, it's a hard sell, especially for some of these kids that are elite athletes, to have a donor site and donor site morbidity that's completely outside of the shoulder. So distal clavicle seems like, Ashley, like you mentioned, it's a kind of a nice idea because you're operating on the shoulder. You just extend the incision a little higher and you're there.
Yeah, it's so tempting. It's just unfortunately limited by size. So when I was looking into this, I mean, it's like 22% and some 25. Well, I don't know about you guys, but in 22 to 25% glenoid bone loss, I'm doing a ladder J, and it has the sling effect, and it's an autograft that's right there. So while it's tempting, I just I wish it was a little bit larger. As Larry and you both perfectly said, you're reaching for that free bone block, usually because it's a bone deficit that can't be compensated by the coracoid. You're reaching for something larger. And so if you want cartilage, that's DTA. And if you're okay without cartilage, that's iliac crest.
So this is an interesting question. I think we're probably going to get a different answer than we would have 5 years ago. But how many people, what are you doing? The French technique, the congruent arc technique, are you doing it open, arthroscopic? If you're doing a Lattergé, Ashley, what do you do for your Lattergés?
Yeah, so I still do the open classic technique, like I was taught BGY5. So I like it. It's reproducible. I like the kind of wider surface being opposed to the glenoid. It's a greater surface for bony healing. I don't worry as much about that non-union or fibrous union we may see with the congruent arc, better kind of hardware, you know, fixation and less concern for graft fragmentation. So that's my approach.
Larry, how about you?
Yeah, French technique, open, subscap split. It's interesting. I spent the month with Gilles Walsh in Lyon, France before he retired, before I started my practice. And over the course of 1 month, I saw him do maybe a dozen arthroscopic Lattergés. And there's a video that's online. You can find it if you search for it or so, of him doing a Lattergé step for step. And you can watch that video 12 times. And it would be like watching him do it 12 different times because it's exactly the same, such a reproducible technique every single time. Question for you, Eric and Ashley, what are your thoughts on screws versus some suspensory fixation?
This was a question on the polls, but it didn't make it into the webinar. So I think it depends on your technique. So if you're doing arthroscopic, you need some sort of specialized fixation device that's proprietary to whatever company you're using. But, I know there's some data cannulated versus non-cannulated. I tend to use cannulated 4-0 screws, but I'll also use a company has a small little claw plate that attaches the two screws. So it kind of diffuses the stress through the coracoid, which I really like. So it makes me feel a little bit more comfortable about using cannulated screws, but also it makes me feel comfortable about using screws in general, because you can sort of spread out some of the stress forces. And I really haven't seen a ton of osteolysis as a result of that. So that little claw plate distributes it nicely. And when you're tightening down the screws in sequence, really the risk of graft fracture is essentially nil because you're distributing the forces evenly.
Yeah, so I do. That's really interesting to hear about, Eric. I like that kind of compression and distributing it. You don't worry about that graft failure as much. So I do two screws. There's a lot of studies on this. There's that paper by Nick Verma, Tony Romo, and Brian Cole looking at comparing like the 3.5 to the 4.0s, cancellous cortical, cannulated solid, and found no difference in failure. So I do a 4.0 cannulated times two.
Larry, what do you do?
Yeah, I do just a small frag. So I'll use a partially threaded 4.0 cancellous screw inferiorly to get compression. And then I just use a 3.5 fully threaded cortical screw superiorly to lock it all in.
Yeah, and I agree with you. That the technique that Gilles has on VuMedi, for those of you who haven't seen it, it's probably the number one watched video in all of VuMedi. And he's truly an artist, and the way he does a Lattergé is magnificent, and it's reproducible. So I tend to do an open French technique also. I've tried arthroscopic when I was a fellow. Charlie Getz and I, we met with George Othwell, and we did a bunch of labs on arthroscopic, and we tried it in a couple patients. And I think, it's a neat idea, and I think there's some people who are really passionate about it. And when you watch Laurent Lafosse do it, it's pretty incredible. But I think in my hands and my practice, from an efficiency standpoint, just from what I'm trying to achieve, you're making probably 5 portals that are about that big, or you're making an incision that's about 3 times as big as one of the portals. You see everything you need to do. It takes 30 to 45 minutes and then you're done. And there's not a lot of futzing. So I tend to scope beforehand, look for any intra-articular pathology, and then I'm opening and I do the standard French Lattergé. All right, Yoni, sorry, we're going to get you involved. This is all technical. We're in the weeds with the surgery stuff, but let's see what the poll says, and we'll keep moving.
If I could do any of those, I'd be a lot wealthier.
Listen, but you make our patients that are stiff from our procedures and the torture that we give them, you make them better. So God bless you. So, all right. So, okay, I think we're winning out. 29% the French technique. We got some congruent arcs. Congruent arc technique is interesting, but I found that a lot of coracoids are pretty narrow, and I worry about graft fracture. And when you're doing a congruent arc technique and you're putting the coracoid on its side, I worry about passing those screws. Have you guys done congruent arc technique? I have not, just because I'm terrified that I'm going to have an issue with the size of the graft and just sitting it down.
Yeah, same thing, Eric. Share your thoughts exactly.
All right. So, wow, this is not as controversial as I was hoping it would be. But if you read the web, if you read the polls on LinkedIn and the other social media sites we're on, everyone is going to hate on us because we are in the minority of some of the folks around us. So, all right, this is Yoni. This is right up your alley. If you choose an arthroscopic soft tissue procedure with RempelSoft, when are we letting these kids go back? So, so maybe before you answer it, Yoni, like, let's talk about post-op protocol. So in an ideal world, the surgeon says status post Bankart plus RempelSoft, evaluate and treat, right? So we all have our own protocols. We all have our own nuance, but you've treated a ton of these and you treat lacrosse players routinely. Tell us how you're rehabbing this patient in an ideal world.
It's far more about functional criteria than it is about time. I mean, no one's returning at 3 months, but if they're not strong enough at 6 months, and we got a lot of ways to test it these days, they're not going back at 6 months. If they're not strong enough at 12 months, you know, they're not going back at 12 months. So once you get out of the healing tissues, like the damage or the help that you guys create and provide, it's all about strength and motor control. And then it's about how sport specific you can get in the rehab process to gauge those things.
So what are your criteria to let someone back to play? What if the surgeon says to you, I'm letting you decide this lacrosse player, this attacker, how are you judging whether or not they are ready to play? You know, time-wise, obviously, you know, most people would argue, I agree, 3 months is probably too soon. But you know, when they're approaching the 4 to 5 to 6 months mark, when are they ready to start taking contact?
So, well, taking contact and returning to sport are two different things, right?
Let's talk about returning to sport unrestricted in this player. So assuming contact.
Yeah. So I like to use something called the athletic shoulder test. We use force plate technology through VOLD to do that. We put them on their stomachs. We gauge their 3 second max isometric test at IYT. That should match contralateral limbs. So that's a great test. It also looks at rate of force development, which does, you know, the force plate stuff is fancy. You're not going to find that in every clinic, but there's a really affordable, like $100 dynamometer called a Tyndek, where you can put these athletes in different positions and gauge how quickly they could ramp up their force, how it compares. Because remember, that's going to be what keeps that sucker in socket past what you guys have repaired. How quickly can that cuff, deltoid, even pec kick in to suck that humerus back in to glenoid to keep it there? And so we test those. And I'd say those are the two biggest objective tests that I'm looking at, provided their range is back. But then if they're working with me, they're taking a check from me or one of our therapists. They're on the field ripping shots. And by the way, when we talk return to sport, Dr. Gallant, I don't know if we talked about this like with baseball, but it is so beautifully documented, your return to throw protocol. We've created our return to shoot protocol because we're in freaking Baltimore, and Galata knows as a Hopkins guy, like it's the mecca of lacrosse.
Are you talking about shooting with guns or shooting with the with a lacrosse stick? You said Baltimore, so it got me nervous there.
Good call. But if you knew Baltimore, lacrosse is Baltimore County. Guns is Baltimore City.
Okay. All right. Just making sure.
So, yes, good call. So anyway,
so you literally check, you take them out back and you destroy them. You tackle them and you make sure they're ready to take hits from the side, basically, you're saying.
Oh, that's the beauty. By the way, this is knowledge for all the surgeons listening. That's the beauty of sending your patients to a legit sports place. We're not taking them to the parking lot because they have to have the facilities to run, jump, change direction, shoot inside the office, because that's a sports facility, right? So but you better believe we're beating the crap out of them on the field in the facility.
That's great. All right. So get back into the weeds. So Ashley, when are you letting this patient go back to play? Assuming you don't have a superstar physical therapist, you just have some random person in the community who says, yeah, they look pretty good. They're doing their T's and their Y's. When are you letting them play?
Yeah. So it's so funny you bring this up, because I was actually going to ask Yoni this, because I'm actually working with a couple therapists in our area to come up with a return to play test like ACL, but for after shoulder stabilization, because we know from ACL that, you know, back in the day, just, oh, 6 months, you look okay. Clearing people was like 30% failure rate. And now we test them, we put them through a whole series of functional movement analyses. And if they fail that test, we do more PT and then we retest them. And once they pass, they have a significantly lower rate of re-tearing their ACL, right? And I think there's some studies out there looking at this for return to play after Bankart. Alverlin looked at this using like the closed kinetic chain upper extremity stability test and like a weighted medicine ball throw. And so we're kind of working on incorporating some of those functional movement tests in order to clear someone to return to play. So while that's not made yet, I, like Yoni, would just want to make sure that people are passing functional movement tests and have that stability in addition to having full strength comparable to the other side, range of motion within 20 degrees and beyond 6 weeks. So to answer that question, it's going to be 6 months, but it's not just time. If anything, time is like a very small portion of it for me. They need to pass those other tests in order for me to feel comfortable clearing them to get back into full sports.
I think well said.
Criteria, sports specific, lacrosse specific, baseball specific, football specific, position specific too. So it's out there.
It's so interesting you say all this stuff, because if you look it up, there's not a ton of research. This is an article I found from JSES about 2 years ago. And it was basically just a survey of surgeons, like seeing what they do. AOSSM surgeons, JSES surgeons, like people in all different subspecialty societies. And, they hem and they haw and they decide when they think they want to go back. And there's not a ton of specific criteria like there is in ACL or maybe other surgeries. We talk about coracoid graft union as something after a Lattergé, but does coracoid graft union equate to someone's ability to get their arm in a certain position and take contact? Probably not. Larry, what are your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, I reiterate everything that everybody said here, and that this is not time-based. It needs to be criteria-based. I think it's still in its infancy. There's a lot of work here to do. I'm telling players it's 5 to 6 months, but that they're going to have to come in and be tested and cleared by the therapist based on these objective metrics.
Yeah, I think it's, and I think most of the polls would agree, 50%, 6 to 7 months. There wasn't a 5 to 6, but I think we kind of did that on purpose because, we didn't want to get too granular. But I think the problem is, like you said, I mean, we really don't have a good criteria that we could put on paper. And it's some nuance that we learn from our physical therapists and athletic trainers. And there's a lot of variability in the therapists and the trainers that we send these patients to, frankly. And just like there's surgeon variability, there's physical therapist variability. And we have to lean on our colleagues that we know and trust, like you, Yoni, and the people we work with in the area, because it really does matter. And it's not just a time-based thing. So I think we all kind of agree on that. So let's talk a little bit about treatment. I'll just tell you what I did briefly, and then you can tell me I did terribly or maybe say something you would do differently. So I did an arthroscopic Bankart with a Remplissage. Controversially, I do this in the beach chair position, and I know that I'm going to get heat for that from a lot of people, but I do it in the beach chair position. I do something a little bit different. I look at it like a helicopter view, and I look down on the glenoid from the rotator interval, and I can work anteriorly and posteriorly, so it's a little different than the traditional posterior viewing portal, so you can see we're viewing the glenoid from up top. There's the Bankart lesion. To the left is anterior, to the right is posterior. Mobilize the glenoid labrum, kind of get it all into one nice sleeve. You can see there's probably not a ton of bone loss, maybe a little blunting, like Larry mentioned early on, of sort of that footprint. It's not as round anteriorly, so figure about 8% bone loss. And then I turn first to the Hill-Sachs defect. So I'm looking at it from up top. There's the Hill-Sachs defect. There's a cannula there, and I kind of abrade the Hill-Sachs defect. And I'll put in two knotless anchors, one at the high end, one at the low end. Right off the articular margin. And I guess I'll pause there for a second. For those of you guys who do this, where do you like to put these anchors? If you have a big Hill-Sachs, a shallow Hill-Sachs, deep Hill-Sachs, I know that this has been sort of debated and there's probably no right answer, but where do you like to put the anchors for your Remplissage? Do you put them right off the articular margin? Do you put them in the middle if it's a big Hill-Sachs? How do you make that determination?
Yeah, I typically put them in the middle. I mean, if it's a small Hill-Sachs like this, I like your placement there. I would put it probably closer to the articular surface. But if you're getting a very broad-based Hill-Sachs lesion, then I'll put them in the middle for fear that I will end up over-constraining that shoulder and limiting their external rotation.
Yeah, because I think I agree. For some of these big Hill-Sachs lesions, if you put them way at the articular margin, you're covering like a decent amount of their footprint. And that's probably, those are the types of patients where you're constraining their infraspinatus and they get cuff pain, I would imagine. Ashley, any other thoughts?
No, I completely agree. A shallow one or a small one like this, I'd put it right at that articular margin. Larger ones, and how do you gauge that? Do you measure it pre-op? I don't know. I think you just look at it and you determine it at the time of surgery. I would put it in the center, definitely. And I would worry if you put it too medial or too close to the margin that you would, perhaps constrain them. And then maybe you'd see some of that loss of motion that people are reporting in the literature. As you were alluding to at the start of this, I haven't seen that in my patients. Their motion has been quite good, but maybe that's because we're doing more central.
So I usually will I'll place the anchors first, and then I'll move towards the labrum portion. I'll tie those anchors at the end. But I think it's really important, and Preventure has said this, and I think many of my mentors, and I'm sure people all over the circuit have said this, I think it's really important to put a posterior inferior anchor, like a 530 anchor in this position, not work anteriorly at, you know, the 7 o'clock position. But if you placate a little inferior capsule, especially in this kid, he's got some inferior capsular laxity, I put a 530 anchor in, placate maybe a half to a centimeter of capsule, and then work around the front. It kind of really sets the stage really nicely to reduce the labrum and get sort of that anatomic bumper. So I used 5 knotless anchors on this in a simple fashion. There's the repair. You can see the AIGHL nicely restored. Do you think 5 anchors is overkill? Do you think I didn't put enough? Should I have put 20 anchors in there? What are you guys doing in terms of your bank card repairs?
I think the more anchors, the better. I think as we talked about a little
earlier, industry people would say that for sure.
And exactly, yeah, this is sponsored by Arthrex. No, I think that when you're talking about anchors, when it was like a 2.9 or even larger, you were limited by your space, right? So I think there's a lot of studies looking at 3 or more in terms of lowering the risk of recurrence. So you at least wanted, you know, 3 or 4. But now that it looks like you use the same anchors that I do, the all suture knotless 1.8 anchors, it's a tiny tunnel, tiny anchor, you can place a lot. So I do as many as I can marching up the surface to really get as many points of fixation as possible.
Larry, how about you? Do you guys use gold-plated anchors at HSS or diamond?
No, I will tell you, I mean, this is spot on exactly how I do it. Again, same anchors. I love looking at that anterolateral kind of over the biceps tendon, high interval portal. That's my workhorse viewing portal. You know, I use it, I do it in the beach chair position as well. One little trick that we'll do is I'll take sheet wadding and wrap it with an ACE wrap. And then we literally stick it into the axilla, and you can jack the joint open and create some space as if you're doing it on traction. I can get to and see 360 degrees. Yep. And I think the entire idea of lateral to Q versus beach chair is completely overrated. It's just really about seeing however it is that you want to position the patient to be able to see. I like the posterior inferior anchor. I you know, it's interesting. I switched these all suture anchors because I had an epiphany one time where I'd had a minor league hockey player who had a bank card from an outside, and he had it with all suture anchors. And then he failed his first season back, like literally just dislocated. And if that was done with hard anchors, I almost would always see a postage stamp fracture in that or some form of considerable bone loss. And this was like he did it for the first time. I think the small track, I mean, provided that the all suture anchors don't cause cysts, which sometimes they can. Yep. But if they don't, which they often don't, I think that when you fail, you're not getting this huge bone loss that you see with the hard anchors.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think these suture anchors, the studies, this, especially the biomechanical ones about the cysts, they do them in cadavers and then they start early range of motion and they start moving it right away. And they talk about these cysts. And I found that those studies, you know, they're really not simulating that period of immobilization and healing of the capsule. And so there's probably a little bit of some nuance there, but I haven't found these anchors to be problematic. And when people redislocate, you know, these kids are obviously taking incredible hits that dislocate their shoulder in the first place, a native anatomic joint. So they can just as well take a hit that's going to dislocate a well-done arthroscopic reconstruction. When you revise them, it's almost like nothing was ever there. It's pretty incredible, actually. Their footprint is low and you could put a lot of them in and it shares the load really well. Do you think there's a role for horizontal mattress sutures? Are these simple sutures not enough? I know there's some data. People talk about doing mattress sutures, throwing them in different configurations. Do you guys do that?
I don't routinely. I typically place the anchor, I pass the repair stitch around. I go in with a kingfisher and I basically kind of lift up the labrum and the bumper and try to pull it not only superiorly, but kind of up as I'm tensioning it. And that kind of brings a nice bumper up. I suppose that if I did a couple of those and I wasn't happy with how the bumper and that reduction was looking, you could place an anchor and do a mattress suture just to kind of give you more of that. But I haven't needed to.
Yeah, I get the impression when you do the mattresses, you almost create a meniscoid labrum that flops around a little bit. And I don't love that. But this device in particular, I've been using the simple, you know, just one technical pro, and I think you did a fantastic job here, you know, but you kind of think about where you're putting the anchors and what you're trying to accomplish. And it's really just arthroscopic or any bank cart repair 101 is that you are obviously trying to raise the sail here. And so you can usually see what they call a radial labral split. And Ralph Hurdle pointed that out to me when I was visiting him in Bern, Switzerland, where you see the labrum is literally transected in the anterior superior quadrant. And then the labrum like tears down from superior to inferior. And when I'm repairing this, I'm trying to reduce that torn portion of labrum back up to where I think that radial labral split is. And you have to use two hands to do that. Like Ashley had said, you know, you need a forceps hand that's picking the things up and you need a stitch hand that's passing your suture device or the stitch through the labrum and tensioning the capsule appropriately. But I think that's a real important technical tip.
Now, it's interesting. I think we've learned so much about arthroscopic Bankart repair that we're all sort of talking the same lingo and doing the same things. And my guess is if you look at the technical aspects of what they were doing with all these high recurrence rates from the data that's presented, you know, 15-year data from maybe 20 years ago, they were not doing these things. I can tell you that much for sure. They're putting anchors, one or two anchors, and hoping for the best from the posterior portal. So I think we've gotten a lot more sophisticated. And I think we can all disagree with our colleague, Dr. Bill Levine, that arthroscopic Bankart is the way to go for this. I'm sorry, Bill. And then just the one final slide about the Rempelsage. That was the before picture here and then the after picture. So I go back and I'll sort of rack and hitch the Rempelsage anchors. I put the working stitch in one and slide it through the other anchor and then back again. Do you guys usually go subacromial? I just make a little like subdeltoid cannula and I kind of do this all blind. Is that wrong of me? Should I be going subacromial to make sure there's no deltoid in there that maybe would prevent some posterior pain?
Yeah, I do. I tie these under direct vision in the subacromial space. So question for you before I get to that more. Eric, do you, when you pass the sutures through the cuff, are you doing it through your standard posterior portal or do you make a posterolateral portal to pass the sutures?
So it's funny you mentioned that because usually when I put this cannula in, it looks like it's a standard posterior portal, but that's like a high posterior lateral portal. That's where I do all my work through. And then when I'm placing the anchors, I actually do a standard posterior portal. So I'll just back the cannula out and then I'll kind of take a bird beak suture passer and then pass it high posterior lateral. So I do it through a kind of a high posterior lateral portal, which is, it sounds like that's kind of what you do when you're, because it needs to be a little higher. It can't be the straight posterior portal or else you're kind of not really lined up with where your Hill Sachs needs to be.
I agree with that. I agree with that too. I also think that if you're going to put that posterior inferior anchor in, you know, that sort of high and outside portal gives you a better trajectory. Because if you're doing it through a standard posterior portal, you really run the risk of skiving the articular cartilage if you're putting it in at that.
Yeah, I think it's, I agree 100%. Mark Lazarus taught me this. When you do a high posterior lateral portal, especially when you have a curved anchor, you can get anywhere you want to go on that glenoid. And your angle is always perfect when you're plicating posteriorly, especially with posterior labral tears. They're so easy. And I think if you put your posterior portal too low and too midline, when you're doing posterior labral work, it's impossible to get the right trajectory. So you're skiving all the time and you can't grab the labrum appropriately.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'll use the cannula. I put the cannula on the bird. I do make a posterior lateral portal. I make my standard posterior portal for my diagnostic arthroscopy. And then I will make a posterior lateral portal as well. I actually put an 8.5 cannula and I put it on the bursal surface. And then I take a bird's beak or penetrator and I pass mattress sutures because the anchor I'll use for this is just a standard cuff anchor.
Okay, so cool.
That I tie. And then what I do is take the cannula, I push it against the bursal side with all the stitches in it and I snap it. And then when I go into the subacromial space, I'm just looking for the cannula. So I'm just taking my choker, looking for the cannula. And then I can even shave around there, figuring that the cannula is protecting my sutures in the bursal side of the rotator cuff. So I can find them pretty easily within like a minute or two and then just tie. And then I know that I'm not tethered in the deltoid or deltoid fascia.
Yeah. That's an interesting way to do it. Use the cannula as your lighthouse.
Yeah.
Exactly. Ashley, any other thoughts?
Yeah, so I do similar to you, Eric. So I do it blindly. So I use my standard posterior portal to prepare the defect. And then I make a high posterior lateral portal about 2 centimeters lateral to the standard portal, kind of with a spinal needle, just make sure I like my trajectory to the central aspect of the Hill Sachs that I can place both anchors. I go in with a standard just 7 millimeter cannula down to the capsule and the infraspinatus. I kind of spin it around to clear as much subacromial tissue as I can. And then I go in with the drill guide with the blunt in it, poke through, drill the anchor, take those sutures out, move the cannula over, again, poke through another one, drill that anchor. And then like you at the end, I cross the repair stitches over and that's how I cinch it down. I haven't had an issue with that. I think if I was tying, I'd want to look subacromial to make sure, but because it's knotless, I just kind of watch it come down and it's done well so far.
Great. So I think that's the end of our structured talks. Any other thoughts? Did we not cover anything? Any other kind of impressions you wanted to give on the case?
So how do you do, Eric?
He did great. He went to play. Yeah, sure. He's actually a year and a half out. And contrary to what the haters will say online, the kid is actually playing lacrosse right now. Or actually, it's the summer, but he finished his freshman year and the kid's a star. So knock on wood, we'll see what happens over the next couple of years. But I think the arthroscopic Bankart plus Remplissage reigns supreme in this case. But, you know, haters will say we haven't followed him nearly far enough. And you might be right about that, but I guess we will see. And I think just as an aside, and I really mean this, you know, I tell this to a lot of patients. When we talk about recurrence, you know, when patients fail after an arthroscopic Bankart, I really think it's important to put into perspective that these kids are, especially the contact athletes, these are superstar athletes that they dislocated a healthy shoulder once, they could dislocate a repaired shoulder again. And I think you could do as much as you can to tighten them, bone graft them. But if you put enough force through any joint, something can break and something can fail. And so, you know, we have to be very critical of our failures, but if we're approaching a 3 or 4% recurrence rate on some of these patients with a standard procedure that has an extraordinarily low complication rate, at least in my mind, to me, that's the way to go. I think when we start looking at Laterges and open Bankart repairs and things that, you know, have a 7-8% complication rate, we can't poo-poo those, because if you have a complication with a Laterges and they get an axillary nerve injury, and unfortunately, I think all of us have seen the complications firsthand of this, it is a devastating injury. And so that gives me a little bit of stage fright when it comes to these tweener cases. I tend to lean more towards arthroscopic because I think, you know, if you do it well, and you choose the right patient in the end, ultimately a recurrence, although I'm not going to, you know, I'll sound terrible saying this, recurrence is not as bad as an axillary nerve injury, but yeah. Anyway, so any other parting thoughts from you guys?
Yoni, just one thing that we didn't go through is maybe the immediate post-op period. I know we had a conversation about the utility of blood flow restriction therapy in the immediate post-op period for these athletes to try to get them back quicker. I don't know if you want to say a word or two about maybe for the audience that's unfamiliar with it, just what it is and how you utilize it in your athletes as you're rehabbing them.
Yeah, sure. And I'd say we're really using it across all of our populations. So blood flow restriction therapy is the use of a tourniquet that gets pumped up and occludes blood flow, really return of blood flow throughout the system. And what it does is, colloquially, the way I refer to it with the patient is, it makes very simple exercises very difficult. So it fatigues muscles very rapidly, and it tricks the brain into thinking that you are under a tremendous amount of load, even though you're not. And so the body responds systemically, releasing human growth hormone, releasing growth factors, so that we can, at the very least, decrease atrophy, but very convincingly increase hypertrophy rates, where we're laying down new tissue. We're also increasing activation rates. So that's the speech I gave before, kind of like how well the brain talks to the cuff. With a tourniquet on your upper arm, there's no question your cuff turns on quicker, and we know that it is activated more aggressively with that cuff on, with convincing carryover. So all of that to say, this is a great reason to push your patients into therapy far earlier than you may have in the past, because there's so much we can do without damaging what you guys did inside the shoulder, respecting the healing rates and times, but also saying, hey, this kid's got to get on the field for University of Maryland, so we got to get that strength back as rapidly as possible. Blood flow restriction is a great way to do it. And now we're even beginning to use it in a recovery technique where it can pump out the poor blood, to kind of let healthy blood in, decrease pain rates fairly rapidly.
Yeah, that's a great. You will see it with the players, with the Mets, they'll use it as recovery. The pitchers come in and do a cool down with the BFR, and they're shocked at how minimal soreness they have the next day. So
yeah.
So that's great. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks for cueing that. And then, Dr. Black, what I would say is, like, overarchingly speaking, like, when we're talking about return to sport, but even as I'm sitting here listening to the nuances of the way the surgeons attack the different shoulders and the wide-ranging interventions that are possible, I think very often PTs are in the dark about that. And I would say vice versa, when you guys are talking about return to sport and protocols and we don't have a protocol for this, or you guys got to be reading also the physical therapy research and literature, where it is nicely documented, where we know what an athlete needs to be able to, what barriers they need to be able to cross so that they can return and decrease that recurrence rate. Like you're talking about, I would say, yeah, your surgeries, your Bankarts have gotten so much better from a technique standpoint. Same thing with the rehab. That's why I love kind of the blending and melding of these worlds.
Yeah, I think that's well put. And I think just, as a final ploy for the Masses meeting coming up soon, this is an incredible meeting for both physicians, PAs, allied health members, physical therapists, occupational therapists. So we're all actively involved in this meeting. And we really try to get a nice broad perspective from a lot of different fields as to how to treat these patients, which are challenging. So thank you guys so much. This was awesome. I learned a lot. It's really great to catch up. Ashley and Larry and Yoni, thank you so much for taking your time out. And thank you to Ortho Bullets for helping to sponsor this webinar. And we really look forward to seeing all of you at Masses this year.
Thank you, Eric. Great presentation. Yeah, thanks, Eric. It was a great
time.
Thanks,
guys.
Great job.